Hello, everyone. I do not know, do we need formal introductions to know everybody who is here and why they're here and what they're looking for a little bit? No, nothing at all? No one word? Don't want to know who is who?
We can give you the names if you want.
You like to stay anonymous? Yes, I know our Rebellions. But I don't know a few people here, new names. Maybe you will say just a name.
Oliver.
Just say your name.
Sama.
Tanya. All right, wonderful. So at least we know who is who, and you can call yourself by your names that we know who is who for yourself. You know everyone here?
No.
No. I am Vladimir, by the way. Yes.
Привет.
Yes. Привет means hi.
My name? No, it's the name of a Russian salad.
Yes.
So it's a little Russian.
So maybe just one round we do before we start. It's good to say names, at least then we will...
Okay, I'll start. I am Ananda, Romanian since 82.
Zygbert. Sandy, Kirti, and Arod, and Nishtha, and Sita. She's called Shiva in India, to make it simpler.
Thank you.
I didn't expect such a crowd. And I made 5 copies of the introduction. And I would throw it to, if you can share, or you need to share, or you would like to see afterwards. So... Yes. Basically, what I would like to say, it's not really important. It's my writings.
I read through it, and I was making a few corrections.
Wonderful. So. Serious. All right, thank you. And then it's legitimate to...
Vladimir hasn't yet learned to where to put the definite article in English.
Right, this is the biggest problem for those who don't have articles in their native languages.
I noticed that you put it where it doesn't go and you didn't put it.
Yes, I put it when I feel it's right place, but then... And I'm many times surprised to read that, why you didn't put the article? It must be there. But you will forgive me that, and you will correct in your mind, if you like to do that, also linguistic exercise. Article is the most unusual thing in language. Do you know that, by the way? This is something which you can't teach or can't learn. There are rules, but... They are all open and they are very intuitive, and it's rather the feeling of language which leads you to this usage. And we were taught in a university that we can't learn it. You have to learn it from your childhood, you have to see all those examples coming to you, and then by that you figure out what is really right way to deal with articles. some people like Germans, they have articles and they are lucky in that sense. They can really project their thinking into English, which is not the same, but still very close to it. But Russians do not have articles at all.
Sanskrit
in them. Yes, we are based on the synthetic perception of language. You know the difference between synthetic, analytic, and agglutinative types. There are different types of languages. There are different ways of thinking. So synthetic way of thinking is one which difficult to define. The definition is given in a very vague manner. That if I can say I go to school in Russian. Hello, please. Well, chairs are required. If I say in Sanskrit, for example, Vidyalayam Gacchami, I go to school, then in English I am going to, maybe their school, I do not know. So if you count how many words you have to express one the same meaning, in synthetic and analytic language, you will have many more words in analytic language. That means there will be words like articles, auxiliary verbs, which are of purely grammatical value and not meaningful to the word. So in Sanskrit, there are only two meaningful words. Vidyalayam gacchami. Now, even there is no I here, because gacchami reflects I in its verb system, in synthetic way. So you have, I go to school, going to school, basically. Two words. The same in Russian, but in analytic language you will have five or six words. So these other words, they are of pure grammatical value. That's the difference between synthetic and analytic as it is defined nowadays in linguistics, which is quite, you know, approximate definition. So if you see, if you take the language from Shakespearean times, you will see that it was more synthetic. It had something of its, and German is an example of that synthetism. You have both possibilities to move towards analytism or more towards synthetism. The same in Sanskrit. Sanskrit is very open language, Indo-European. You can move towards analytism more and make all those prefixes and auxiliary words more available and express yourself in more analytic way, yes, or more synthetic way. So this is a very interesting distinction. Agglutinative type is another type. It's Tamil language, and you can see that not only Tamil, Korean, Japanese, and other languages, Turkish.
Basque?
I do not know about Basque, the most probably, yes. Hungarian. They are all these Finnish. They are completely different type, yes. And once Shubhendu said that they are coming from the same source, I couldn't believe it, yes, because I was studying already linguistics in the university, and then I had to reconsider the whole agglutination in a Tamil language. So agglutinative type does not have prefixation. It starts with a root and adds many, many, many affixes. So you have one word with, you know, like children in Hungary, they are playing with these words. They are creating long texts by one word. That's for them a play. In their mind it is possible. Prefixation is not allowed. You cannot have prefixation before the root. Root has to be first always. It's a must. It's kind of interesting thing.
It's very honest. Huh? It's a very honest way to communicate.
Yes. Well, we will go into that concept of upasargas, of prefixation, how it was seen in Sanskrit, and it's quite interesting. Upasarga means that which was before creation. Yeah? If the root is considered to be seen as a creation, then that which precedes the creation, the presumption of creation, which defines it in a very indirect but decisive way, is upasarga, prefixation. Moreover, in a Vedic Sanskrit you find prefixation free from the root, and it can stay in any position in the text. Yeah? It can be in the beginning, it can be in the post position to the verb, or it can stand by itself without the verb at all, which is very unusual. You have only prefix and verb is implied. But I don't want to go into this. You see, we started with привет, and there was a remark about articles which I'm using in a wrong way, and I started to analyze the whole thing on analytism, synthetism, and agglutinative types. We will come to that if there would be a question about it. There are also other types, like isolative type, which was mentioned by Aurelio, that we are not paying attention to it. It's a Chinese language. Isolative type, a very unusual way of seeing the world, where the distinction between the subject and object is very vague, and the symbol in itself is defining those relations, which are always implied, always understood by the context. Now, the context is essential for Chinese language. So, isolative type means that you have isolated symbols which are meaningful, but combined they give you an interpretative symbol which is open to interpretation. And it is, of course, graphical language. It's not vocal as we are operating it from Indo-European languages. Okay, now before I start, that was a preliminary remark, but the introduction is called Comparative Study. Of the concept of the word in the Eastern and Western thought. I wrote the whole essay and I sent to Rod for corrections of English. It will be corrected and will be posted most probably on the website, so you will have access to it. You don't need to have this text. It's for me to follow the program. So the first thing, have you seen the program, what we are intending to do? Yes. So we are starting with one first global observation, and then we move towards Vedic concept of the word. Then we are drifting towards Upanishadic, and from Upanishads to Bhartrihari, and finally to Tantra. From there we take a leap towards 19th century in Europe, and we study Humboldt, we start with Humboldt, and we move towards Saussure and Chomsky at the end. We end with Sri Aurobindo and general observation towards new linguistics. So the whole exercise was meant to lead us through all those stages and all those findings in the linguistics, in the history of linguistics, which will be useful for us as a background or as a foundation or as a language by which we will operate searching for new science of language. Sri Aurobindo was very enthusiastic about it because he, as he says himself, he was given this knowledge by Krishna. The meaning of the sound and meaning was revealed to him in the deepest sense. So he saw the origins, and he knows how from those origins roots were created, and from roots families of words and so on. Have you read his Origins of Aryan Speech, by the way? Somebody? Too strong, yes? Too difficult to read. For me it was the most difficult text to read of Sri Aurobindo, that Origins of Aryan Speech. And you know why? Because he deals with roots. And if you deal with roots, you have to cover all the semantic field, all possible semantic formations later, which he tried to do. Moreover, he did it in a very interesting manner, analytic manner. He compared them with all possible roots which could be there in language. It's not necessarily that they were there, but they could be created by this device if understanding is there. It's like you have the system of chemistry tables, yes? And in the system of Mendeleev, I do not know how you call it in English.
You call it Mendeleev.
Mendeleev, still. In India, most probably, but not in America. There must be somebody else who invented it. So this table of chemistry tables, when you see the elements, how they relate in their positions and in their semantics, so to say, how many electrons and protons they have, that's their semantic field. So positioning and the meaning of this table is very similar in Sanskrit language. So the meaning of the sound, the color of the sound, and the semantic are going together, building up roots, and these roots giving life to words which carry certain significances. Very general, but later they become more concrete and more in contextual meanings. They get that what we call words, yes? Meaningful words. But none of them is indicating or denoting the object. The object is rather described by that application of the root. It's a description, it's an adjective. So Sanskrit has that particular difficulty for all of us to think in those terms about language. So it's always creative. You have to use your creative power to create the word and to apply it into the context. Now, saying all that, just to start with, because I will be dealing around this main issue of semantics. Basically, the whole course is designed to present the material, but in a particular focus, to see how semantic relates to the sound. Now, before I start, I wanted to... still before I start... what I wanted to mention here is something which is very interesting, and I discovered it recently. For me, it was the beginning of rational explanation of linguistics. The shift of paradigms. It seems that we do not know what it is, because we operate within a modern language and a modern mindset and thinking in a modern way. But for people who think in Sanskrit and speak Sanskrit, the world is quite different than it is to us. And after experiencing it myself, after being in the campus for 21 days, speaking, thinking, and doing everything in Sanskrit only with 800 scholars from all over India, when I came out from that camp, I saw another world. It was a different world. I never knew it. I never knew that the world can be in that particular way. My neighbors were brilliant and wonderful people. They were no more enemies.
Sorry, I don't close the door.
First of all, what I noticed was that there are no such concepts like don't worry, be happy, or, you know, things which are presuming you being something you are not. All these things which are existing in English, how we think, or in any other language, were not there. There was another perception of the world, another expression of your own inner being, other categories by which you had to see yourself and others, relate to them differently through other categories. And that was for me a revelation. So it seems that we all live in our linguistic world. Yes? French people, they have quite different perception of the world than English have. We speak about it, but we really don't realize how deep it is. And when I change to Russian, I notice also that the world is completely different. It's a bizarre world, you know. Very aggressive, very critical. I'm sure that French is also most probably that. It becomes critical.
Yeah? He finds better friends than any other friend.
There's something there which is in the language itself, which makes you be that being, which you are not. Maybe you are a different being. How do you know? How would you know if you would not use other languages? But this is one shift from one language to another. Can you imagine another shift? From different times, or from different mindsets, or different epistemological paradigms. And that is something completely unique. Now, Sanskrit started from the times of 6000 BC, and it is the same language as we know it, yes? Vedic language, the same language running through all these millennia, and we are now operating, we are thinking in it, and we are coming to that text, and we see the difference. The difference is within the world perception and self-perception. Now, I would like to deal with these shifts of paradigms which are only possible within the Sanskrit language frame work. But we can also see it in Greek and Latin and maybe some other languages who have longer history. I'm not sure about English, how far we can go with that, or French or any other language. I think Sanskrit is the only chance for us to see that shift of paradigms.
Because it encompasses such a long
story. Right. Moreover, I think it gives us an opportunity to think and to see the world in a more integral way. Well, but that is the conclusion of my talk. So, to come to that conclusion, I have to slowly develop this thinking with you together. Please, by the way, if you want to interrupt or say something or to make remarks, you're most welcome.
I just wanted to mention...
This is strong.
Maybe a little bit what's the situation with Hebrew and Arabic, for example?
Yes, Hebrew and Arabic languages, they are Semitic languages. They belong to another group, another set. It's quite different also dramatically and... otherwise, it has its own syntax, which is unique, yes? Which always starts with a verb. Verb has a tendency to be at the beginning of the sentence and not at the end, as we have it in Indo-European languages. But still, it is an interesting, and even writing goes the other way around. Well, it doesn't matter which way it goes, but the thing is that what is interesting about it, that it is also very ancient language which preserved its own syllabic way of thinking about language. And here I would like to talk more on what is syllabic and what is alphabetic, and where alphabetic appears, and what it did to our perception of language. It was a major shift of paradigm. Introduction of alphabetic language, A, B, C, D, as we know it. Actually, Hebrew is responsible for that introduction, and Hebrew scripts especially, because it was Aleph, Bet, and so on, which became A, B, C, D, later in Greek, alphabet. But before we go to that, to mention this shift, I would like to speak about the shift in different contexts. One context is linguistics, of course. Other context would be philosophical. The other approach I would like to see is sociological. What happened to our social structure? How we shifted? What was the shift? Yes? And the final would be psychological, of course. Because psychology, linguistics, and philosophy and sociology are going very close together. So let us start from that time when psychology and philosophy were one discipline and one approach, where there was no difference between metaphysical vision and psychological participation. They split later. They split in the rational time, when there was introduction of rational thinking, or rational structure of consciousness. Now, I would say that I'm trying to operate within certain terminology, which I'm using from Gebser. Those of you who know his work. And Sri Aurobindo's, who is using also Lamprecht's division of the periods of time or paradigms. I'm not using, for example, traditional Indian division on Satya Yuga and so on yugas, though it is also in the same direction or similar direction, we can see the same development. But if we take, for example, Sri Aurobindo's division and Gebserian division, so we will have several ages or several different structures of consciousness. So the first one would be the most archaic. Then we have magical. Now with this al, you will forgive me, sometimes it is there, sometimes it is not. Magical. Now there are two ways to say mythical and mythic. I will say mythical. If you don't like al, you can drop it. Mythic is better? It's a better feeling.
Mythic is more restricted meaning.
Mythical is more approach, more epistemological, that's what I feel. Then we have rational. And finally, we have that what we call integral. Not integral. Not integral. There are so many ways to say it. We were discussing it. How many ways to say it? Because most probably it is integral. So these five structures of consciousness are suggested by Gebser. And there are also different five stages suggested by Sri Aurobindo. And it's quite interesting. It's from Lamprecht. There would be symbolic age. But these are not structures, they are ages, which may be, how to say, which we may find useful for this structure of Gebser. Symbolic. Wow. Typo, right. Thank you. Typo, conventional. Individualistic. Basically, we are moving to the rational, individual, yeah? Individualistic. And mystic. And finally, we have what he calls subjective. So, this it's quite interesting because when Gebser discovered Sri Aurobindo later, after writing his book, he found that it makes sense in this particular way of thinking. These are the stages or the ages which are described in the human cycle.
The human cycle.
The human cycle. He took this scheme actually from Lamprecht, a German scholar, and found it very useful for the description of what he describes in the human cycle. Why I am writing all this for so long, just because we will be shifting now, drifting from one paradigm to another with all our material and especially linguistic data, and we will try to see meaning in that shift. So what kind of language could be there at the beginning of time when the age, archaic age, was, there was no distinction between subjective and objective yet in rational terms. It was something more all-included perception of the being. What kind of mentality should be there, and what kind of language this mentality should be expressed in? What do you think? Do you have some ideas?
Yes, symbols.
Symbols, right. Symbolic age, yes.
Magical.
Yeah, it's next stage. Yes, right. It's still there, yes, it is there brooding. Magical, it's subjective perception. Yes. Yes, it's like children. Do you see the same development of one human being, starting from childhood, growing to our beautiful time of our childhood magic, and then becoming this story-liking person from the mother, from grandmother, and then growing into this adolescence who is kind of half teenager, who wants to assert himself in everything, and then finally, after all that, becoming something different. Trying to embrace all the ages of development, all the structures of consciousness which were determining our progress as within one being. It's quite interesting in a way. Well, some people say that after this you go back. Yeah. You become more and more archaic.
I have a feeling that the symbolic comes in between the archaic and the magical. That the archaic is such a distant sort of pre-linguistic period that, you know, we discover language when it starts to become symbolic in history. But before it starts to become symbolic, there's also language. And in that state where there are still no symbols, then the consciousness and the communication must be very fluid with emotion and sensation and memory and vision.
With the right perception.
Yeah, I fully agree. I like this description, what you did. Yes, well, there was a beginning. So somehow beginning is marked by that archaic something which we do not know what it is, where subjective and objective is not yet defined in proper terms. So there's something going on within the subject which subject does not define in objective terms yet. Of course, then it becomes a magic. This is the magic. The next stage will be working out the magic, working out the communication in those subjective terms. Now, it's very good to define these things. You know why? Because when we will come to the integral stage, we will need those definitions. Because they will be that valuable material which we will not have otherwise. It has to go to undergo transformation, but later it will come to that we actually embody all these stages or structures of consciousness into one integral stage. Moreover, Gebser says in an interesting way that all of these can exist only on the ground or on presumption that the integral stage already is there somewhere. It is as if kind of leading all these stages in their progress on development, otherwise they would not really progress or they would not really be there. So if the integral one would not determine all of them from the very beginning, why they should be there if they are not moving towards their own self-realization in the integral stage.
So in this case, integral should not be just subjective, it should be like a reintegration of subject and object, like in archaic, with awareness that was not made in archaic.
Yeah. Again, the subjective comes prior to the integral. There's not a direct correspondence.
There's no equation.
Yeah, well, of course, these are two different systems. I didn't put them equally. No, but they have correlation.
And then, partial.
Yeah, but what we will have to see why, because this is more...
And this is not about language so much. These are stages of civilization.
Exactly. These are ages. These ages which are reflecting certain psychology. This is kind of social psychology paradigm, whereas this something is more relating to our structure of consciousness. So in a way they have to have correspondence, otherwise how? But we have to understand how and why. And if we understand them, we will see the shift of paradigms in linguistics. Now, so symbolic age where all the symbols outer and inner symbols were the same. And what is interesting about it is that Shubhendu describes that Vedic Rishis, what they did, how they hid their knowledge. They hid their knowledge by using symbols of the outer nature. It's the best way to hide the knowledge. You know, if you say the sun is rising, how can you preserve that knowledge better and hide it better than in those symbols of outer nature which correspond to the inner truth? Now, the inner truth, the inner symbolism, the inner revelation was exactly corresponding to the outer nature. And it wasn't done artificially. It was seen through. It was perceived. It was understood as that the whole universe as it is created is a symbol of that particular happening. It is not because it exists and we have something else that we can compare them, but because there is a divine within us and in cosmos which makes this for us so obviously clear in terms of, in the language of the cosmos, to our inner being, that they correspond fully. They are not in rational terms compared and made symbol of each other.
So,
this is the archaic perception.
So why you speak of hiding? If it is like this, there's nothing to hide.
You are right.
Absolutely parallel.
You're right. I speak about hiding in our rational terms. Because otherwise how would you say it to your rationality that it will be surprised? It won't be even seeing the difference. We are so rational already. We need that distinction. If I don't point to it, we would not see it. We would not feel it. So that is the archaic or symbolic, where the outer symbols and inner symbols were the same symbols, which is difficult, nearly impossible now to understand. We feel the gap of time, yeah? So we feel that it's another structure of consciousness to which, though it is deeply ours, we never left it. We developed on that ground all other structures. It is our foundation. It is deep within us. That's why we can recognize it. That's why we can come back to it. Now, once that started to be projected outside as a magic, the relation, a magic relation with the outer world, the distinction between inner and outer, there are types, typal relations are coming into the consciousness. And the most difficult stage, magical, mythical, would be much easier. There's something going on there between subject and object, and subject is still trying to survive and dominate and expand himself. It's like children, you know, child psychology. When he is born, he doesn't understand. The child doesn't understand that he cannot take this thing because it is far. He wants to take it and it doesn't come. Why? It commands it. It cries. And this thing is not coming. So he has to extend his hand. Because in this time and space relation, this object and subject, there's something else happening, some gap between the two, which he has to cross. Now, in his perception, in his magic, archaic perception, it should be possible to get it by will. But it doesn't come. Somehow you have to stretch towards it. And that's that magical building up relation of your subject to the outer relation with the world. Now, mythical is something more defined. All these relations became symbols fixed, or names, or not concepts yet, powers, images, beings, which are recognized in ourselves and outside, with which we are dealing in a particular way. They have relations with us. They had relations with our ancestors. They like certain things, we like certain things. We have with them certain relations, and that is the story of the myth. There are conventions coming in that the Ganesha likes laddus on this particular day, and on that particular day he wants coconut. And nothing you can do about it, it's fixed already story. You have to bring coconuts on that day, and on that. And that's how it is. It's a convention. Maybe Ganesh already changed his mind. Maybe he likes something else altogether. But convention will not permit him liking anything else but coconut on that day.
Coca-Cola.
Huh? Coca-Cola, maybe. He liked sweets, by the way. The story of Ganesh, as you remember, the snake wanted to kill him, this asura. And he presented him the heel of laddus, because he knew that Ganesha cannot stop, he likes sweets. So he thought he will eat and his belly will break. So he did, he ate and his belly broke. But then Ganesha took all those sweets back into the belly, and then he was looking for something to tie it up, and he found the snake looking and tie up the snake on his belly. That's why the snake is on his belly. This is the myth, a convention, but it's an interesting myth. It fixes certain particular force or power of nature into a particular form with which we can come into contact and have conscious relations. Now, this is the time of Brahmanas and Aranyakas. Now, if I can split it, this for me was the beginning of the Vedic thinking, or pre-Vedic even, as Rod rightly said. It is the time of those archaic, to which Vedas refer as archaic, saying that there was a time where the knowledge was there, old, of old. It's already old rishis of the Vedas speak. Then there was the development of all these relations with the world, universe and yourself, where you can grow or benefit or fall or develop. This is magical. Then mythical stage of fixing it into the form of the stories, Brahmanas, Aranyakas, Upanishads and later Puranas. We all like stories. Yes, we are half adults, so to say. We are not fully adults. Stories are the closest to us. That's why we like movies, we like Superman, X-Men, Spider-Man, any man you give us, we would love to watch. I love to watch them again and again, though I know already by heart all of the dialogues. Still, there is this a very strange possibility to have different relations with yourself and the world, freer or more, less rational, so to say, yes? Less fixed, less finalized in the rigid material and conventional forms. Now, when the rational stage comes, we have another, completely another development, and that is where I want to draw our attention fully to. And that corresponds with an individualistic development of the mind, of the ratio, thinking. In the Indian history, it will correspond to the time of Shastras, the beginning of rational thinking. All these sciences, science of Vyakarana, is the biggest, the most powerful beginning of rationalization. By the way, Vyakarana Panini is written in the language which is most modern and suitable for computers languages. And there are several institutions are dealing with that. In Pune is one, another is in Japan. And they are thinking that this, the Sanskrit language can be used for programming because it's transparent, it's very rich. And I will show you the richness of Sanskrit, where you can develop an immense number, open number of all possible forms in the most transparent way. So you will recognize them. For example, how many participles you have in English? Participle 1 and participle 2. Okay, you can have several more, yes? 10, 12, 14, having done, having been done, so on, all these different participles you can create. In Sanskrit, I can create for you, I just did for myself exercise, 124 different forms. And they are all readable. I know what they mean. The grammar is transparent. It supports it. You can see it clearly. I will show you that, those schemes. You will see how you can develop within the grammar, very transparent, building up the meaning. So why I'm saying this? Because Sanskrit has a potential of rationality, great potential. Because of this uninterrupted tradition, this is my conclusion of the talk. But because we lost in our languages that tradition, we are kind of thinking within the mindset of another language, which was created later, 200 years back, 300 years back. Russian language is 400, English 5, I don't know, French 4. So what happened within those 400 years? We started to think differently. We think that we know the world by those means of that language. But we do not have access to another way of thinking. We do not have that background which has to support this integral development. Now, rational structure of consciousness is, as Gebser describes it, is the most aggressive, the most, I will give you the quotations, they are all here. Most destructive, demanding.
Reductionist.
Yes. It wants everyone to see the world in this way. Yes, it does not permit any kind of approximity or any kind of freedom. It is. I would rather quote from Gebser than tell you, but it is in another section. Sorry. So the rational structure of consciousness is absolutely needed to sharpen our mind and to sharpen the discrimination within the mind to smallest, minutest detail, without which integral stage will not come into existence. Now, saying that, I justify the rational structure. Though, if you take it exclusively and build on it only, you will have a that picture, monstrosity of some kind about which Mother was speaking, that this mind cannot know the truth unless it has a background, unless it has a depth. But of course we have to develop rationality, without which we cannot really progress and move into the integral stage. Now after the time of Shastras and Panini Ashtadhyayi and Vyakarana and Tantras, which was a kind of leaping back to the Vedic times with the rational mindset, which is very interesting. You will see how differently they are treating that material rationally, and that's why they were not trusted by the scholars, because they say, how come you make rational conclusions on the irrational matters? This is the problem with Tantra. But still, the consciousness has changed already. Because there was a new time, new way of thinking, new mentality. Though the matter stayed still of that kind. And then the integral is quite open, we do not know what it is.
Could you date more or less this rational time for Indian?
Yes, 500 BC. Well, it's the same for Greeks. It's around 500 BC. Actually, many things happened around 500 BC. Buddha, Mahavira, Socrates, all these movements, they are coming in that time. Panini Ashtadhyayi, 500 BC, Darshanas.
What were the last two?
Darshanas?
Darshanas.
Darshanas are six philosophical systems. Of course, they all develop from 500 BC onwards. Yes, we have great Vyakarana, 500 BC. Of Panini, we have Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, 200 BC, we have Mahabhashya of Patanjali, even some people say that it is the same Patanjali, which is very possible, 200 BC. We have Sankhya system. Sankhya would be for us a landmark of the change of consciousness. This would be a shift to rational structure. And we will have to stop and to see Sankhya more in detail, and what was there before and what happened after. As you know, after this course there will be another part of our seminars in University of Human Unity, is the course on philosophy of evolution, which is very fundamentally relating to all these issues. You can mark them in another context and see them in the context of the development of species. Would be interesting to compare. And here Rod is sitting, he will be presenting the course. So basically, I made for you an introduction in which framework I will work with you throughout this course. This was only an introduction, a first touch. Now we will go into the text and see how they correspond and do they really make sense with this particular scheme. If you like, you can read this text for yourself, and we can do it in this way, that we will discuss it again for 10 or 15 minutes every time. If you have questions for the next session, that you will look into these shifts, because they are more particularly in a more precise manner written in philosophy, in linguistics, in sociology, and in psychology. And especially linguistics, I would like you to see that part. And we could discuss, if you have some questions, next time, and see what we can arrive at. For now, do you have some questions?
Can you say generally something about the science of linguistics, or because all those first
takes too much in Panini and Quatrain. It's all working. It was one of the first sciences. Why so? Why did our preoccupation with language itself is such a deep quest for humanity?
Well, this is such a philosophical question and requires philosophical answer. Basically, answer is simple. There is no other tool in human being which expresses consciousness. It's language. Language is the only thing we have. Actually, somebody even said that we don't have any other history. We have only history of language and linguistic development. Because that is how consciousness grows and develops. It is through expression of consciousness in language that we know what we are. We know our consciousness. How else would we know? That's what Bhartrihari asks. For Bhartrihari, the language is the way to liberation. There is no other way. What do? We meet and we talk. Endlessly. Everything.
And we misunderstand.
And we misunderstand and understand and all the time move from misunderstanding to partial understanding. And what is that? What is really happening when we talk? Or when you listen? When I listen to what I say? Do I listen to what I say? I do.
I think we should bracket that statement that it's the only way we have to communicate consciousness.
Right.
Because I think what you said just now is to communicate understanding. It's what we have to communicate understanding. But in the magical period, you can imagine that individuals and groups of people had certain accumulated experiences which gave them a sense of being able to achieve something, but they didn't understand either how to communicate that or how it was being achieved. And yet they managed to communicate in various ways to get the results
and do magic.
And we call it magic.
Right.
But actually it's just a complex manipulation of events.
Right.
So then as the understanding evolves, as those memories and experiences accumulate, the language also develops for the purpose of historically capturing the event and how it happens and why it happens and when it happens and where it happens. And so it's, I think, more closely akin to communicating understanding. Consciousness is prior.
Absolutely. So the consciousness, when it vibrates according to the Veda, and we will start with Vedic understanding, the word is the vibration of consciousness. When it vibrates, it gives this vibration to the system which will articulate it in vibration given here in this apparatus and will recreate that vibration of consciousness here. So when we speak in a meaningful way, it seems that meaning vibrates. What vibrates basically when the word vibrates? Why meaning follows the vibration of the word? Was there some other vibration prior to that? Yes, there was, Shubhendu says. If we assume that this word which vibrates here was vibrating before in the vital plane, in the subtle plane, then why can't we presume that before vibrating in the vital plane, it didn't vibrate in the mental? So it was vibrating in the mental before it came into the energy, and then it created this vibration here, articulation, to express it or to communicate it. So if that was the case, then the vibration prior to this was in the supramental, from where the word originates. So what is this word which comes down?
Also say that language never expresses what we really mean. You know, we're forever trying to say what we mean when we never
the gap between the experience and then the spoken.
Mm.
Of course, when we talk about the essence of sound, again, then it's related to time, because that essence of sound takes us into the present.
Right. It's interesting that you mentioned that, what we mean, because all, in all these rational languages which we are operating now with, this meaning is that that you have to always inquire, do you know what I mean? You always ask, do you know what I mean? Why can't we say exactly what we mean? Because we mean something else, and actually we are not fully aware what we mean. We do not know really what we meant. So we ask, do you know what I mean? In hope, maybe you will tell me. I know. You know what I mean often. God. Otherwise it makes no sense.
And so, then of course, the real communication happens without language. And we all know that. We've experienced it in moments of communion. And we see that all the time, horribly.
Right.
Anyhow, but anywhere in the world, the real communication happens without any language at all. It's,
But this might be still language.
Sorry?
Even if it's not something
it's not
or
sounding,
articulation,
it's
still language.
Yeah. Yes.
The radiation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I like your comment. I would give the same comment. I think it is language.
Mm-hmm.
It is because we created the context in which we can vibrate or vibrate silently.
Mm-hmm.
That would be silence. There is a vibration, presence of consciousness creates for us the ground of understanding. And that's how Bhartrihari defines it. For him, all the meanings in the world, they correspond to one meaning of ever-present, always-present consciousness, or Brahman. All of these meanings are justified there. That's why we know in which context we speak. That's why we can ask, do you know what I mean? Because you may have better access to the context of my meaning than I do. And when I was joking about it, there is a drop of truth in that joke. Because the context is wider than the expression which comes through this particular formation.
That's what's rendering the conversation very interesting, because by bouncing off each other's, the consciousness find ourselves perhaps expressing something that exceeds our own understanding at times, just because of the relationship.
Right, right.
To the other.
Right.
So you can say actually that the word is like a means, or like a tool for consciousness.
It's an expression of consciousness.
But a creative.
It is created. Now, when we now speak mainly in linguistics, you will notice the definition of the language will be given that the function, the main function, will be communicative. And you will find it in all the textbooks nowadays. But communication, what is really communication? Communication is here somewhere. But what other levels of language there are, so on? And that is the question. And I think the creative aspect and cognitive are as important as communicating. Because when I speak to you, I speak to myself. And if it doesn't make sense to me, how it will make sense to you? I am listening to what I say. I am always alert to that. I am interested to say to myself something which I do not know. I am not trying to tell you what I know. So that is the expression of consciousness in the world. It will be registered by my outer consciousness as coming from the inner, and I will recognize it and grow into the perception of it. Well, that is this spot.
We
the modern, what is the noise in communication? Because when you listen to radio or TV, or when you listen, when you go to the internet, in the web, when you surf, you see a lot of unnecessary writings and blah, blah, blah. And sometimes you ask yourself, what is the real thing which is true to be said and exchanged? So I think that we are in a world where there is so much noise in terms of communication. And this is why I'm putting the question.
So where is the signal? Yeah. Who decides what is the signal and what is noise? How?
It's a fundamental question, yes. As if there are two different ways of speaking. Yes? As if. There is one which is vertical, so to say, where you are connected to the truthfulness of yourself. And other is horizontal, where the repercussions, so to say, of the same, the repetitions, bouncing of the already created words who do not know where to go, and they are still trying to come to your tongue and to push you and to pollute you and to make you believe that they are everything. But in all that noise, if you align yourself again with vertical capacity to speak, they will regroup all those noises and they will start playing a meaningful context. You will find them meaningful. I was using even an example of a very interesting and very most difficult example is repetition of the same word. Yeah, Japa, for example. Or if I take one word, Rama, and I say Rama, 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 Rama. Every Rama is different from previous Rama. Why and how? How come that every Rama is not the same Rama? Well, there is a very simple explanation, yes, because of time factor, because of context, which has changed with every Rama added to it. It's another context, it's another time, it's another perception, other sharpness of consciousness, other approach to word Rama, to the name Rama. Every time is another dimension coming in. Why? Because of this factor that you cannot but be true to yourself in the given moment of time. Now, if I align myself with this, I will perceive only the truth. But if I don't, I will hear the same thing, boring to death. So it depends on perception. Well, it doesn't make much sense, but maybe it's time-wise. So for today we end, and yes, if you want to make some comments, observations, you're most welcome. It's the most exciting subject for myself and for you, as I see. So we have still a few minutes, so please.
When we're speaking about the repetition of a word or mantra or whatever, and how it's inscribed in time, and it prompted to my thinking that's why recorded, electronically recorded repetitions are so tiresome, because they're exactly the same and there's no variation of frequencies, so they don't resonate, and after a while it becomes so flat and exhausting, because there's no, you know, it could go endlessly until the end of time and still be the same without any shift.
I like that's what you say. This is very, very important statement, and it is very deep, because every time when we speak, there has to be this alignment to now, to this, to the actuality of, to the truthfulness of this moment. Now, when that was truthfulness in that time, it is great, yes? We can feel that. It is still there. somehow reminding us, because the alignment is perceptible, we can perceive it, we can really experience it again, but that won't be the same anymore.
I have this image of what makes us vertical as humans, you know, in comparison to the animals. What's that upright movement, you could say, is that through the power of the bird actually becoming into that vertical, or because of the verticality we can receive the power.
I think you already answered. And this is, yes, because of both, yes? It has a loop. It creates in us this alignment, and it demands this alignment to be real. That's why the word in Sanskrit is never untrue. The word is always true. It's the context into which we put the true word which lies to us. But the word can't lie. You are beautiful is not a lie. Or you are stupid is not a lie also. But it depends in which context you put and when you use it. Yes? That's why in Sanskrit it's quite interesting. There is no word for lie. There is no lie in Sanskrit, there is only truth. Satyam and Ritam. But there is asatyam. Unritam. Yes. The truth which is not actual now. The truth which is not actual in this space and time. You speak the truth, but truth which is not applicable for this particular time and space. Maybe it's somewhere else true. Not now.
So A means inadequation, it doesn't mean negation.
It means not negation. It means non-actualization. The truth which is not actual to this particular time and space you speak, but this is the truth and not a lie. And there is no word for lie, by the way.
That's a wonderful tool for my
yes.
To know that nobody ever says lie, really.
Yeah. So everybody can say lies.
The context lies, but the word is true. And there is a deep truth in it, if you look deeper into this. Because the consciousness expressing itself cannot lie. It is how it is applied, into which context, that the lie appears. All right, so we end today with this, and we will have a small break, and then we have another session.
During this break, we haven't discussed how to manage the transition.
Would you like to have something during this break? Maybe we should.
What is it, 15 minutes? Yeah.
It could be shorter, but it could also. If we had a plan to have Jews or. Something.
Should we?
There's water.
There is water, unfortunately, instead of juice, but we can arrange next time juice if you want, on Wednesdays and Mondays. Who comes on Mondays? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.